tape number 5 of the ongoing interview with Professor Harold Shoaib, August 17th, 2005, talking about your teaching philosophy.
I've learned over the years that I've learned how to do this. You know, that I do understand that one might feel that when you get to exam number 247, that you're repeating yourself and just doing sort of cliched kinds of comments. But I'm able to look at the blue books, the essays, individually, I feel, and to assess them on an individual basis. I have in the evenings before each of the exams, I have a writing workshop. And I provide students with handouts about what I expect on essays. I'm very demanding on essays. I'm not interested in a lot of generalizations and so forth. I want very precise analysis. So I'm really trying to teach the students to be analytical. What they have to do is they get the essay questions in advance, so they can think about them before the exam. But they only have a 50-minute exam. They have 25 minutes to write the essay, so they really have to be focused to write the essay. And I tell them, Samuel Johnson once said that the knowledge that you're going to be hanged tomorrow concentrates the mind wonderfully. And I think that these essays help people to really concentrate, really focus themselves. And the students initially fight against that. They really like these vast generalizations and so forth. And I won't let them do that. And so it's an interesting intellectual kind of a struggle that goes on. So I spend a lot of, especially on the first exam, a lot of time. And what I do is I read the essay first, and then as I tell my students when they get the essays back, it looks as if I've bled all over your essays because they've got red markings all over the place. And then what I do is for each student, I type into my computer, specific comments about their paper. And as I tell them, these are not, this is not kind of a generalized kind of a thing. These are specific comments about their paper, where they've gone wrong, where they've gone right, what they have to do to improve this. And the second exam is a bit of an improvement. Not great, but a bit of improvement, so I spend a lot of time on that exam as well. But the final exams are typically just wonderful. First of all, it's their last chance, the adrenaline is flowing, and my hope is that they've learned something from the first two exams so that they can really do a nice job on the final exam. And generally they do. They get 30% of the grade on the first exam, 30% on the second exam, and 40% on the final. But I also place a lot of emphasis on improvement. So if a student had a C on the first exam, and a B on the second exam, and an A on the final exam, the student has an A in the course, because that's the kind of gradation I like to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I see exams not as an end in themselves, but as a part of a process, of a semester process. And, by and large, it works. Some students, have difficulty with this. And when they do, I have students, they can come up and talk to me. I'll give them sample essays, questions. They can write them. I'll read them in preparation for the exam. And I do a lot of that sort of thing. So that if the students really are concerned, there are all kinds of things they can do to make sure that they're going to do well when they're working under these time pressures on the examination. So I believe in exams. I think that exams can be very useful, but I also see them as an educational tool. That this is something that students can learn from. So I like that. And other things, make perhaps idiosyncrasies. I will not allow my students to come in late, nor to leave early. I tell them 50 minutes, three days a week. It's not too much to ask that these 50 minutes belong to us in the classroom. And in a big room, I don't want people coming and going constantly because it's very disruptive. And very disruptive to me and the way I teach. Because the way I teach is I internalize my lecture the night before. And I have my notes there, but I'm moving around in that big room. And if people are moving around and so forth, it's just very disruptive for me. But I also urge students to ask questions, to talk to me while in this big class. And over time, I'm able to break down their sort of reticence about talking in this big class. And so students are talking about my lecture and things that we're doing. So I demand that they be there regularly, and I also take roll every day. There are rosters that go around.
Oh, you do?
Yes. And if they are told this, if they miss four times, their final grade is lowered by one full grade, and so on. So they have to come to class. I told them they have to make a commitment to this. They have to be there. And I know they're adults, but I also know that students, if this is not done, they'll come and go as they wish. And for me, as I tell them, the course builds. If you miss one of the lectures, then you've missed a building block of the course. So I expect them to be there. All of this is made plain to them on day one. So if they don't like that, then they can quit. They can go take another course. But they've got to, so there are some idiosyncrasies in that, but the those are I think those are important. But what's really exciting about the course, when I go in there, my adrenaline is flowing. I can't have an office hour an hour before that class because I'm up the wall, and that's been the case ever since I've been teaching. It remains the case. I'm really very tense before lecture. Once I'm in there, 2 minutes into the lecture, I'm okay, then I'm flowing. And by the time it's over, because remember, 500 students, so it takes a lot of psychological energy on the part of the teacher to hold that group together. Because it's 11 o'clock in the morning, but 11 o'clock is very early for a lot of students. And so, they come in with their own, 500 different interests and so forth, and I've got to bind them quickly for 15 minutes. But it's wonderful. When I go from a class of 500 to a seminar with 5 or 10 people in it, I like both of them, but they're very different ways, very different approaches to teaching. And so I know that big universities like this, that they have this, they're often castigated because they have big classes like mine. So I think that big classes can be a problem and can be a bore, but I also think that big classes can also be, extraordinary and can be a lot of fun to teach and maybe even a lot of fun to attend.
It's been said that you're a bit of a showman.
A ham is the word. Yes. I think that teachers have that in them. And there's no question, when I'm in that big classroom, it is a much broader kind of a thing. I know halfway through a lecture when I'm bombing, there's nothing happening. I hate that. It's my fault, when that happened. Especially in the big class, but in my small classes as well. I've always felt that actors are repressed teachers, and I think that that teachers have this acting in them as well. So, oh yeah, very definitely, and I love that part of it too. Teaching is the center of my universe. Everything that I have done, my research in Africa, my writing, everything that I do goes to the classroom. That's my passion. I love teaching. I absolutely love it. And it's the reason I went into this field. I loved what happened in Africa. I loved my research in Africa. And I like writing. I like all of that part of it. But everything is the classroom. What happens in the classroom. And I tell the students, I believe in the classroom. I believe in the sanctity of the classroom. That this is where ideas reign. And I may be pushy about my ideas, but that doesn't mean that students cannot have their own ideas and that we cannot debate these ideas.
Do you get students who will, in fact, challenge you?
Yes. Perhaps not as much as I would like, especially in the big class. And I think that the big class is intimidating. And I come on pretty heavy, and so maybe I can be a bit intimidating as well. But I try to create an atmosphere where they can feel free to talk. you know, it's not easy in a big room. Yes. And sometimes it's more successful than other times. And remember, from the 80s, late 80s and the 90s, we went through this, we're still feeling it here, this period of political correctness. And it really did have a chilling effect on the classroom. No question about it.
Really?
Students were not talking about things that they used to talk about. Women's issues. We read a novel from Egypt by a woman, which raises very important international women's issues. And when I first started teaching that novel, the class was irrepressible. But now they won't touch it. I kid them about that. They're afraid to talk about this thing. And I think faculty are afraid to talk about some things as well. I think that's one of the worst things that in my experience here that's happened at the University of Wisconsin, and not only here, but in universities throughout the country, we know this, is this period of political correctness when we have to be very careful about what we say. And I hate it that it hits me, but it does. That I have to be more careful about what I say in the classroom, and students ultimately careful.
How does it hit you? Give me an example of how it's affected your teaching.
Well, for example, I teach a course on hero and trickster, and the trickster character is one of the most irrepressible characters that exist. Psychologists Jung and Freud just had a field day with the trickster character internationally. And when I first started teaching the course, no holds were barred. He is an absolutely outrageous character from a sexual point of view, from every possible point of view. He's a boundary character. And everybody wants to sort of tame him and make him a kind of a Bugs Bunny, type a trickster,
yes,
and so forth. Or Walt Disney-ize him or Dr. Seuss-ize him. And I refuse to do that. And but the way I teach the trickster now and the way I taught him 20 years ago is a big distinction between them. I tell the students this. I still give him enough of a rough edge, sexually and so forth, so they can see that aspect of him. But no more do I go into it, full force and really show what this kind of character is like. And that's too bad.
Yes.
And I hate myself for that. But that's one of the stultifying effects that it has had from a student's point of view. They will not get engaged in questions that have to do with gender. Sometimes they will. But only because I try to suggest to them that they're afraid to talk about this stuff, and they won't talk about it, because everybody's looking at them, and it's just as easy not to talk about it, not to talk about women's issues, not to talk about issues of race and so forth. And so I think that what has happened is we talk about it, but in a proper, kind of a way. And so that has had an impact on ideas in the classroom, and I hate that is happening. But it's very definitely here. We have committees, there have been committees on the campus that have been dedicated to really having a restrictive influence on what goes on in the classroom. And I don't like that. One of the big, great things about Wisconsin has always been the freedom of thought, that the classroom is a sacred place where ideas reign. And look, I had a student who wrote to the chancellor last year accusing me of being anti-Christian. And the chancellor wrote a wonderful, absolutely wonderful, I've got it framed over there, a wonderful letter back to him in which he argued for, this is Chancellor Wiley, who argued for freedom of speech in the classroom. This was because I was dealing with the novels deal with the Christian missionaries. Houseboy, one of the novels, and another, Things Fall Apart. And so I was talking about, the Christian missionaries in Africa. And that offended him. And he also was offended by the fact that I was not as critical of Muslims and Islam as I should have been. So what he was expecting, really, very angrily expecting, was a certain kind of a point of view. And that, now that I would never cave into. Yes. But it's not the only letter that has been written. I had somebody write to Dean Certain when he was the dean, when I was teaching this Egyptian novel, accusing me of being a pervert. That's the word he used, because of the way I was teaching about women's issues, and he finally apologized in written form to me and to the dean. But you know, I tell the students this: ideas hit you hard, and so that, you know, the pervert letter, the Christian letter, that doesn't bother me much. You know, that didn't bother me because this is part of the deal. And in both cases, Certain and Wiley, there was 100% support for me and what goes on in the classroom. So, and I like that. So on the one hand, we have this darned political correctness thing. But on the other hand, we have you know, people with far-reaching ideas like Wiley and Certain who keep this who keep this flame burning. And so this is, again, if I get enough sort of perspective on the thing, this is a worthwhile kind of a debate. It's not only happening here, it's happening in every university in this country. And, you know, students accuse me regularly of being too liberal. Over the years, as a student body seems to have become more conservative, or at least more openly conservative, they give me trouble. After 7/11, 9/11. I still remember I gave a lecture about that. I didn't feel that a teacher could avoid that. I devoted part of the lecture to that, and that was very positively received from the students. You never know. Then there's this, when we're talking about the sanctity of the classroom. This is one of the most dramatic things that have ever occurred to me, and I think one of the most dramatic things that happens in any classroom. Not sure exactly when this was, in the 80s sometime. When I give exams in the class, I have to give the exams in several rooms because they have alternate seating. And if I have 500 students, then in that particular semester, I had exams in 272 Bascom, in the 165 Bascom on the first floor, and then one in Ingram Hall. And what happens is I have, proctors in each of the classrooms. And then what I do is I walk around to each of the classrooms several times answering questions. I tell the proctors they're not to answer any content questions because, they haven't been in the course. So that's what I do, I walk around. So, 12 weeks exam, second exam, and in 272 Bascom, I get things started in the big classroom and then I move around to the other two. I was going to 165 and then over to Ingram. So I gave the instructions for the exam, and I thought that there was something extraordinary going on in the back of the classroom, a bit of, people were settled, but not as settled as, I just wasn't feeling right about it. And I told the proctors to keep an eye on these people in the back of the room. And then having given my instructions, it was about 10 minutes then into the exam, I went downstairs in Bascom, and when I came to 165, one of the proctors came running out and said, "Get that guy." And there were several students who were rushing out of the classroom over to where the Abraham Lincoln statue is, out of Bascom. And the class was in an uproar. And I quickly found out that from the proctors that they had disrupted the exam, and cursing and things like this.
Really?
Yeah.
In the exam?
Yeah. And so I went down to the front of the classroom, and I really had to, I had a 50-minute exam, and I had to get these students, back into the exam, in exam mode. I remember that somebody had given me a Superman T-shirt, and I happened to be wearing it that day. So I went down to the front of the, what happened was, it gets even more interesting. As I was, what happened was one of the students who had disrupted it had left behind a T-shirt that he had purchased at the bookstore, a brand new T-shirt, on a seat. So I took that, and I was walking to the front of the room, and suddenly I was attacked from behind. The guy leapt on me, apparently
physically.
Yeah, and by that time, my students were no longer putting up with this. They were on their feet, and so the guy, then left me alone and ran out again. So I went to the front of the room. Now people were really in uproar, and I remember ripping my shirt open. And, there was Superman. And I said, "You're safe, you're safe." And they all laughed, and it sort of diffused it a little bit. And I got them back into the exam mode. Then I really knew that something had gone, if something was wrong here, there was probably going to be something wrong in 272. So I ran out of the room, having got things sort of settled in 165. As I ran out, the Dean of Students' office was at that time, was on the first floor. And I stuck my head into the Dean of Students' office, and I said, "My world is falling apart." They said, "Should we call the police?" I said, "I think it's too late." And I ran up to the second floor, and 272 had just been disrupted. It's again the cursing, shouting, and so forth. Then I got that settled, and I ran over to in Graham Hall, and nothing had happened there. Well, I really had a problem here. How could I? Taking exams is tough anyway. And what happens when the exam is disrupted? How can I? I expect, for example, students in those two rooms to be judged in the same way that the students in the other room, who were not disrupted. It was a problem. Well, that night, it was on, these are, my, I give my exams on Fridays, over at the KK, Accounts Club. One of my students was a reporter for the Daily Cardinal, and she was in the KK, and these guys came in. And the guy who had leapt on me, she asked him, what was that all about? And, why did you do that? And one of them said, "Because that's where the niggers are." And then all hell broke loose. Because race had been introduced into it. And it turns out that these guys were from the University of Illinois. And they were up here on, fraternities have these meetings of, these brotherly meetings, fraternal meetings.
Yes.
They're from Acacia. From Illinois, and they were visiting the Acacia people up here. The minute race came into it, and then it was, of course, the headlines in the newspapers, or it was big in the newspapers anyway, and Gene Parks then, he came into my classroom, and he asked me if he could talk to the students, and I allowed him to talk to the students, to talk briefly, to try to put some perspective in this, and then they had a huge march down Langdon Street to Acacia House to protest what had happened. It wasn't necessarily the fault of the Acacia people here. It was these guys from Illinois. Well, this thing took on a life of its own. It was in the spring semester. First thing I had to do was to give a makeup exam for students who felt that they needed to take it because of the disruption. And about 70 students took it. People still remember it to this day. They'll talk about this, that they probably didn't get the grade they deserved because of what had happened. And then these students, and there were about, I can't remember how many, five, six, seven. They were tried by a faculty student body down at Champaign-Urbana. And in the summertime, actually, one of my colleagues, her class, was also disrupted. And so we had to go down to Champaign-Urbana, to give witness or whatever to this these committees. I remember these guys, or their parents were there. All we did was we just said what had happened, what we from our point of view, and then we left. They made the students do. Community work as a part of it. I think the student who attacked me was kicked out of school. And then what happened here was that my students then sued them. And the lawyers were trying to get me to bring a suit against this other guy, and I refused. But my students sued them. And so they settled out of court. I think each student got $50 or something from the fraternity down in Illinois. So it went on into the summer. It just seemed like it was never going to be over.
At the time of the incident, when you were assaulted, you did not realize that it was racial in nature.
No, and
it was just a disruption.
Yeah, it was a disruption. Actually, they were drunk. it turns out, and whether it was because of the reason he gave or just because they were being disrupted, they did not shout. The shouts that they made were invective, but they were not racial in nature. And they insisted, because, you know, going across state lines to cause this racial disruption is a national, it's a
federal
offense. And so their lawyer, they got lawyers, and their lawyers insisted it was just a you know, fraternity prank, and in order to keep it out of the courts. And I think that, you know, as the thing went on, people were not anxious to, you know, to go through the courts and so forth. They had to come up here, make a trip up here, and in the presence of the chancellor, actually, Phil Certain was sitting in for the chancellor at that time, they had to formally apologize to me for what had happened. And, you know, the class was already gone, so they couldn't apologize to the class. So that was a very dramatic event. I can't imagine that anything like that would ever happen to me again, but it was very dramatic. When the guy leapt on me, I wasn't hurt or anything. I was just very surprised. But and the students were ready then. They'd had it, and they were going to tear this guy apart, I think, or at least, you know, get him off my back. I think the student reaction. It was their decision to sue them. My interest was in the course and to make sure that this, you know, the course. I think that the general response of the students, you know, was pretty good. We got back into the run of things again. Whether or not this disruption, I have no doubt that it probably did, had a negative influence on the grades, even those who took the makeup exam. I mean, there was not much I could do about that, and I simply had to deal with it as best I could. So it was that part of it was the only, from an academic point of view, was the only, you know, difficult. I really had to be very careful about the grading and so forth that I did.
It puts me in mind, though, of what Crawford Young said about you when he was dean, that you had the respect of your students and you earned it the old-fashioned way with intellectual rigor.
Yeah, students take to me. Some of them, it takes a time. You know, they fight the heck out of me. The course is not. Some time ago, Rolling Stone. I still remember Pee Wee Herman was on the cover. Easy courses,
yes,
in the United States, and mine was among them. And I was infuriated by this, you know, because it's not, I didn't think it was a gut course. And a lot of my students wrote letters to Rolling Stone, and Rolling Stone said, you know, just back off. This is just, you know, was done in humor. But as some of my students said, you know, any ink is good ink. that suddenly the course had passed even beyond Madison, Wisconsin. They had a description of the course and about this professor who moved wildly up and down the aisles lecturing and so forth. So they did a real caricature of me and the thing. Anyway, I saw the humor in it. But the course has really been an interesting course. I have a lot of over the years, retired people who come to take, sit in on the course and take it. The university has that wonderful opportunity that they give to older people. I have a number of students just can't handle my style, and they'll drop out of the course. So, and I agree that I'm not everybody's cup of tea. Teachers are teachers, and but generally, I think that, and there are times when I just absolutely bomb in the classroom, nothing goes well. But when I look at the courses overall, I don't think that any time I ever taught that course, I ever feel that the whole course was a loss. I think that maybe there were ups and downs in the class, which inevitably is going to happen, but. But it's just been a wonderful experience, and it still remains challenging right up into the present moment. And I'm comforted by the fact that there's a Catherine Cornell, who was an American actor years ago.
Yes.
And she said once, I remember that that before every performance, she got her stomach was in upheaval. She was very nervous, and she said her argument was, the minute that stops, it's time for me to go. And you know, I think that's the case. I get very excited before the course. I think that once that stops, then I'm not a teacher anymore. I think that's part of it. That excitement, even the dread, you know, going into that classroom. And when I walk into 272, it's just an extraordinary experience for me, and remains that case. So to go back to your comment about acting, yeah, it is like acting. And every time it's different, maybe not major differences, but every time I do it, nothing is canned. I'm ready for, you know, for whatever happens in the classroom. I absolutely love it. And here's a case where the stuff that I did in Africa is directly channeled into the classroom. It's very much a part of that course. I talk to students about experiences I've had with rites of passage in Africa, where I've seen.
This is side two of tape 5 of the oral history interview with Professor Harold Schoitz.
I talked to them about how I have, when I was in Uganda, I went into the Congo and saw a New Year's celebration of the Mbuti people, the so-called pygmies of the great rainforest of Central Africa, and I described that. So things, I'm able, this is one of the wonderful things about Wisconsin, is, and one of the things that Wisconsin boasts about, and I think rightly so, is that the things that are taught here are things that were actually experienced here. And the idea that textbooks are written here. I mean, the textbook that I use for the oral traditions part of that course is a textbook that I wrote. Are put together, and so I think that I take it very, very seriously that the experiences that I've had I want to bring into the classroom. And the thing is that this has all kinds of influences, I think, including, you know, students who decide at some point in their lives that they're going to go abroad somewhere, maybe not necessarily Africa, but they're going somewhere. I talk to them about this idea that that going to another place and staying in another place for a time, as I said earlier, that this is the greatest education that you can have. And I tell them about how this university has always had, from the moment of its inception, the largest percentage of its students going into the Peace Corps of any institution in this country. And we know from statistically last year that was also the case.
Really?
Yes.
That
has been the case all these years. And so there is that climate at this university that encourages this sort of thing. And of course, we also, a lot of our students spend their junior years abroad, and some of them spend those years in Africa. So anyway, so 210 is only one of the courses that I teach, the African Storyteller. But
it is one of the signature courses of the university.
And for me too. I really do love it. And so when they made this decision earlier this year to take away the ethnic studies, I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. So it was I'm happy that the course is still a large course, and I'm once again looking forward to that. When I first started the course, there was no ethnic studies requirement on this campus. That came later on. I was involved in the ethnic studies, the decisions, you know, to have ethnic studies requirements. And my argument from the start was the vastness of this university, and therefore this, you know, ethnic studies, as I said, should include not just African-American, Hispanic-American, but more generally, because after all, you know, there's Africa and the diaspora, which had an enormous influence on the United States in any case.
Absolutely.
They weren't buying this. So that saddens me, and I think that we really have to struggle against that very narrow view of what this university is. That this university, the strength of this university, is in that breadth, and I think that that should be reflected in our requirements here.
Of course, this comes from the man who's sitting with me here, who advocated for permitting George Wallace to come
yes.
to Valparaiso,
absolutely.
Which was, to my mind, of course, the correct position, but it ran counter to the prevailing mm-hmm. ethic of the day.
That's right, absolutely. And you have to be ready to do that. I mean, I have students who get very upset with me, and students get upset with me for all kinds of reasons. For example, I gave a lecture once, and then I wrote an article for a local newspaper about how, we were going through a difficult period after the 1960s, and my argument was that this is a transitional phase, that what we're really moving into, my hope is, a situation when skin color is no longer of importance. And people were furious.
Really?
Blacks were furious. Because skin color, we were moving into this area of diversity, and diversity became a very big thing on this campus, and I'm arguing against diversity. I'm arguing for Eleanor Roosevelt, One World. That's the thing. And therefore, skin color at the moment is unimportant. I don't know if I can tell this story without getting emotional about it. But this wonderful woman, Mazitatu Zenani.
Yes.
Apartheid South Africa, you know, where racial, the lines of race are drawn very, very firmly. So here we are, early 1970s, the pits of apartheid. A big audience out here, she's telling a story. And then when her story is over, and I remember I was piddling around with the tape recorder. I think I had to change the tape or something. And suddenly she grabs me and pulls me against her. And our cheeks are like this, just as hard as, I remember, as hard as they could be. And she shouted out to the audience, "Are we not the same? Are we not the same?" And everybody shouted, including me, "We are the same." You know, I can't tell that story without getting emotional, but it's at the heart of what I believe in. So sometimes you get into trouble with that. And I did, this idea that race, color has become so important in our country. And I'm saying that in the end, what Africa has taught me is that in the end, color is unimportant. I quote this wonderful woman, this writer, this African-American writer, I forgot her first name, West. I have a picture of her on the when I give my final lecture in the course at 2:10. And she says, in effect, that in the end, color was unimportant. Love was the important thing. And that is my underlying sort of theme in this course, in my courses. And we were going through a period where, and we still are, where diversity and color become very, very important. I mean, after all, a couple of years ago, there was an effort to have, 8 different racial classifications
yes.
in this country. And in South Africa, they had 4 racial classifications. And I saw what happened when this happened. When you're born if you're black, you're born in a hospital, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
When you die, you've got to be put into a black cemetery. And my whole career, my whole life has been against that sort of thing.
Yes.
But in the 60s, when I went down south, all these other people, I was convinced that we were changing a nation. And that we were getting rid of this racial thing, going to St. Louis and seeing coloreds only, on the Johns and so forth. And in South Africa, everything was on park benches, whites only, and so forth. And so I do confess that I'm on this issue, I really don't, maybe I don't brook much dissent on this. The big, big lesson that Africa has to teach us is that we make a big mistake, and we have for hundreds of years of dividing us into us and them. And we continue to do that, And not only, in this country do whites insist upon that. Many black intellectuals insist upon that too, and that saddens me. And I think we need that debate, but it's a dangerous debate.
Yeah, my hope has been with the celebration of diversity that it be treated as a stage. The acknowledgement of the diversity you have to acknowledge in order to get to the one world.
No, I agree with that. And the thing is that we have, as I said earlier, that this country has never done what South Africa did, and that is to acknowledge our past. Yes, I think that I think that this country has a terrible record of its relationships with blacks and with people with Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans. So I think that. I think that what has to happen here, Steve Biko argued that before Africans can consider themselves equal to whites, they must accept themselves as Africans. And they must, and in fact, the whole negritude movement in Western Africa too said, we have to accept our ideas, we have to accept our blackness. We have to accept our history, and not the history that the whites paint of us, but our own history, which is a splendid history. And then we can move, the third stage of negritude is called synthesis, and that's when you move into equality, total equality. But before you can move into equality with the whites and the rest of the world, you have to accept yourself. You have to accept who you are. And all these things that the whites have been castigating you for all these years. And so what came out of that was the black is beautiful idea, and some people got stuck in that. Yes. But the idea of negritude was that's a stage, as you said. And you have what happened where there are three stages of negritude. One is separation, alienation, whites and blacks living side by side and not being able to make contact with each other. That's what happened in this country, happened all over Africa. The second stage is acceptance. Moving back psychologically, spiritually to the African past and accepting who I am, accepting the color of my skin, accepting my history. And only then can we move into the third stage, which is synthesis, equality, with the whole world around us. Nothing to be ashamed of. We are the same. Okay, and so the we are the same thing is what has attracted me. And so I think that to get caught in that second stage is very dangerous, but it's also very dangerous. I learned, to discuss that, and so I lost some friends on this campus.
Is that some of what you meant by your earlier reference to the stultifying effect of political correctness?
Yeah, that's a part of it, and in fact, it goes on right now. I mean, there have been, this is a continuing effort here, and that saddens me. I believe that in these various departments, African language literature, Afro-American studies, and so forth, I think these are areas of worthy of study. But I don't think that they should become I don't think that these should become victims' courses. Or anything like that. I think these are courses where we learn about things, the past and the present, but that should not have an impact on this essential aspect of humanity, and that is that in the end, black or white, there's no distinction. I mean, skin color. Living in Africa as long as I have, this obsession with skin color, which the whites had in South Africa, and which now in this country whites and blacks both have, is not only unnecessary. I think that it creates unnecessary barriers between human beings. So I'm for, and this is without any question a major issue in my African storyteller course. The idea that that in the end. There's no distinction between human beings, and that's, this is what African writers are saying. If people will allow the African writers to have their voice and not force history upon them, but letting their characters and so forth express themselves within the aesthetics of the work of art, This is what there are, or not all of them, but many of them are arguing.
Do you get a lot of Afro-American kids in your town?
It varies. Sometimes it's larger and other times it's not. After all, we don't have that large an African-American population here.
Right.
But I've had many really interesting conversations with both African-American and white students about the racial situation. I mean, you can't talk about African literature, the second half of the course, without talking about race, because that's what these novels are all about, or gender, in this Egyptian novel. So these are delicate subjects, very delicate subjects. And so, you know, but I'm one of those fools who walk in where angels fear to tread. I think that this is important, that we get into these kinds of discussions, as politically incorrect as they might be, and talk about them.
My personal position is that race is the defining issue for the United States of America.
And it will remain so. I think that the United States is very uncomfortable with its past, but as we've seen in the last 2 years, not willing to look at its past. Yes. And I think that's going to be a problem for a long time. The quest for reparations, you know, that's okay, but doesn't interest me much. Mm-hmm. There's something far more important than you know, two mules and an acre. I think we have to, as these writers do, as artists do, we have to look beyond the moment, and we're caught in the moment, and it can be, you know, it can be very uncomfortable. I hate it that I've lost friends here. Because of my views, but you know, when also this is a place of ideas, and we have to be honest about our ideas, and the idea that people are afraid to talk about this, people are afraid to to express opinions, that might people think fear might be misunderstood. I say you take a chance. This is the place, and I tell myself, if you're not going to do it here, where the heck are you going to do it? You know, here in a university, this is one of the things that happens here, is that ideas happen. And especially this university, which is known for it. You know, what happened in the 60s is only the most dramatic aspect of the University of Wisconsin, when the whole world was aware of what was happening here. But it's always been the case here. And so the kind of struggle that goes on it's been a long time, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now into the new century. The kind of struggle that's going on is a struggle in which people will not let go of these hard, these hard-fought ideas. And I think that we have to, get into a mode where we can really talk openly without, destroying each other in the process.
Harold, I want to switch now to your role as a citizen of the university, and your service has been considerable, wide-ranging. You've been sought out to serve, to chair a variety of committees, and we're interested for the record in your observations about your service and what you have done.
I have been, as I mentioned earlier, I've been chair of my own department a number of times, and during some pretty crucial times in the department. I was once was chair of African Studies program as well, and so I've been I've been on regularly, as one might imagine, on committees within the department, my activities on committees in this department have not been without their ups and downs as well. I still remember a few years ago when the chair took me out to lunch. I absolutely refuse to go out to lunch with anybody anymore, because it's always something negative happens. And what she was doing was taking me off the graduate. I was on the committee. I was the head of the committee for graduate studies in the department, because I was being too, from her point of view, I was being too narrow in my interpretation of the department's requirements. From my point of view, I was being very demanding about the department requirements were. So anyway, that's part of the deal. Beyond that, yes, several things. Probably the most exhausting, but one of the most important committees that I've been on has been faculty appeals, which I'll be on again next week, on August 26th. This happens at the end of each semester and at the end of the summer, when students who have been asked to leave the university for academic reasons appeal to be readmitted. Typically the students are, before they come to the Faculty Appeals Committee, they will have had some kind of indication, they're on probation or something, that they're in academic difficulty. And typically what happens is they have to leave the university for a year, and then they can reapply to get back in. But some students, and they have a right to do this, reapply right away to get back in. So these are really exhausting, emotionally exhausting. It's a committee of faculty members and deans, and the students come before you, and it's also a defining moment for students. It's not easy, to make these pleas. So there are a lot of tears, a lot of emotion, and it's very, very tough. The committees are generally, it's not easy for the students to gain access, because they've had, for whatever reason, they've had academic difficulties, and if we feel that there are problems, here that can be immediately, overcome, then we'll allow the student to come back in. But more often, we think that it's a good idea for the student to be out for a year and think about this and then come back again. So those are tough. That's a tough one, but I believe in that.
How do you get on that committee?
They ask you to be on it.
They meaning?
I can't remember. I was on it for years. I've been on it for years. I think that I was asked by a dean or somebody to be on it initially, and it's not an easy committee, but it's a very important one. So I believe in that. I'm not interested in committees. I'm really awful on committees where people just sit around and don't do much, or just talk or something like that. I'm on a committee, I want the committee to get to work and do what the work is done, and then I'm excited about it. If it's a creative, active committee, then I'm excited about it. Otherwise, I don't want to be on committees. I'm not interested in, committees can drive you crazy. And I know from talking to people that some people, they can't wait for retirement because the committees are driving them crazy. I like committees because I believe in faculty governance. As long as the committees are really being creative and are actively engaged in something. I've been on committees having to do with whether or not we should have a component at the university in Puerto Rican studies and gay studies and so forth. And those have been useful kinds of committees. Another very difficult committee, and these are committees that are assigned by the dean of the college, have had to do with reviews of departments. And departments have to be reviewed, internal reviews. I'm not quite sure what the exact, about every 10 years, I think.
Oh, all departments?
All departments have to be reviewed. And some of them are reviewed more, if they're having difficulties, are reviewed more often. Some of them, for example, I'm on a committee now that is going to be, is going to be an outside executive committee for a department that is foundering. And these are tough, again, because you attend every meeting and the regular faculty is there, but you're there as well. And so what you're trying to do is get them over a hump, a difficult period in the lives of the department. But I've also chaired several committees that have, in the normal kind of every 10-year movement, where you look at the committee, interview all the faculty, interview students, grad students, undergrads. It's a very long, exhausting process. Take notes, and you have a committee, and so everybody is working on this, and we come together frequently. And these can be very tough. They're very nervous. When our department has them, it makes everybody very nervous. And these committees can be very critical, negatively critical, or they can be very positive. In this department, the most recent review that we had, which was 2 years ago, came out quite positive. We were very happy about that. One of the programs that I chaired the review of was a positive one. It really was a very easy thing to do because everything was moving so smoothly. It was a real pleasure to be a part of that. The other two were rough. One of them was in a long time ago, I think the late 70s or something, maybe the late 80s. And what happens is that, people take these very personally and they don't forget them. Coming out of these two committees I'm thinking about, to this day, people will not talk to me. I remember once walking up the 14th floor here, and coming down the stairs was somebody from one of these departments, and suddenly he becomes very interested in the hose. That there's a hose thing down there, and so he's looking at the hose, so he doesn't have to face me, and that's sort of thing. It's really tough. These are not fun. These committees are really tough, especially if the department is having difficulties.
But you apparently were willing to take the assignment.
I was, and the most recent one was really tough. The department was having big problems, so it really needed a review.
And the department was?
Anthropology. And, I think we had, when it was all over, I think I hauled 17 volumes of materials, that I had sort of put together in these binders and
oh
so forth.
Oh my God.
I don't know what they probably destroyed them. All the interviews, we had interview after interview. And without going to any specifics, the fact was that, that there were problems. These problems were manageable, but there were problems. It was very, the people were very frank with us, faculty and students. And I think we talked to just about every student, certainly every graduate student, and many of the undergrads, and all the faculty a number of times. And, so we met the committee. This committee was just absolutely magnificent. One of the committee members is now at Oxford. One of them has retired. One of them is a chair right now. It was just a wonderful group of people. And in fact, at one point, the committee had to be disbanded because the department argued that there were members of the committee who had preconceived notions about the committee. So I have to confess, by that time I was hoping the dean would take me off and replace me with somebody, because it was a tough one. This was really tough. But I remained the chair of it. And I still remember that when we presented the final report to the dean, the chair of anthropology refused to accept it. He was very, very upset. And so the dean then sent copies individually to every member of the faculty. And the upshot, it was a very tough, people were really angry. It was the headlines of one of the papers saying, they got a hold of this. Saying it's a jungle in there, that was the headline about, and I really regretted that they referred to me as the paper did, the chair of the committee, as a overly sort of emotional kind of a person, and I didn't think that was entirely fair, but these criticism is tough. I don't take criticism easily at all. I take it, but not happily. When students write evaluations for me, I can't face them until 6 weeks after the course. In the summertime, I read them in the middle of the summer, for those for the spring semester. They're very tough. Students are, you know, these evaluations are really very open, very tough. And these evaluations, we met again and again, the committee, and played with the language of the report.
This was in the mid-1990s, was it?
I can't remember the exact, I think so, I think that's right. The 1992 to 1993. And you know, we didn't do a follow-up. We don't do that. But it's my understanding that the department is in good shape now. I think that members of the faculty would argue it was always in good shape, and that that the committee had erred. The whole thing, the whole dynamics of these kinds of things, you know, you talk to individual faculty members, and then you talk to faculty members as a group, and you're getting all kinds of perspectives of the thing.
I don't know how you find the truth.
No. And so we had to do as best we could, and then we made recommendations and so forth, as we always do. But these are not easy. And people do not get over this. You know, it's understandable. People take their departments very seriously, and they take this as a personal assault. I've come under criticism often, in all kinds of ways, and it's not easy. I do understand that. But I also took this committee very, very seriously. That it was very important that we do what we had to do. Anyway, here's some interesting things. It was really a tough time for me. I think it was around early in the fall semester that all this had happened. And I was walking down Bascom Hill, and it was within, a couple weeks that it had been, all the explosion was all over the place. And the chancellor, David Ward, was walking down the hill, and he told me that, this really meant a lot to me. He said that that it took a humanist to say what the social scientist should have said a long time ago, or something like that. And that meant a lot to me. It reminded me of another time with another chancellor, and that was Donna Shalala, when I was chairman of this department, and we had a disruptive, really rough time with